With our guest tonight, Richard C. Hoagland. If you want to see the heading on the NighthawkZone.com, take a look at what they've done to Richard C. Hoagland and me, I guess, for that matter. Good artwork, by the way. They've got Richard on Mars. I'm not too far away. Back in a moment as we talk now about this incredible anti-gravity. How much did we know? How much do we know? So, Richard C., Sputnik goes, and then we go. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sputnik goes October 4th, 57. Shock sets in. Suddenly, the fetters and the ties and the prohibitions and the actual memoranda and directives that had come down through the Pentagon prohibiting von Braun and his team from accidentally launching a satellite earlier.
Accidentally?
I mean, there's literally, it's on the record. Just Google. You can Google all this stuff. This government, forbid von Braun and his team from accidentally launching a satellite. They literally, with their Jupiter C booster, if they had added a fourth solid-stage rocket, could have put something into orbit. You know, the joke was they could have put a beer can in orbit, and it would have been something in orbit before the Russians.
That's right.
They were specifically forbidden, under pain of Leavenworth, from doing that. They had to put sand in that fourth stage to simulate the weight for their ICBM warhead test, so they didn't accidentally launch something ahead of the Russians, because it was all about Eisenhower and his political open skies idea.
Jeez.
And maybe that other hidden agenda that we talked about in the last hour.
Yeah.
So Sputnik happens, and suddenly, you know, McElroy and the other guys all up and down the chain of command, including the White House, are to von Braun, when can you get a satellite up? When can you get a satellite up? And he says 90 days. Actually, he said, 90 days. And that's what they did. Now, the reason they were able to do that is because secretly
they were ready.
They were ready. They had actually mothballed in what they called permanent room temperature storage, long-term lifetime test, a rocket, the upper stage solid rockets, all the hardware. So they just basically had to get it out of storage, dust it off, and assemble it and launch. And they did that in 84 days. So they weren't going from a standing start. They actually had everything ready based on the idea that the Navy would flop. Remember, in December, the Navy tried to launch Vanguard, and the thing rose a foot off the pad and then fell back with a crescendo of incredible pyrotechnics and explosions.
Yes.
And thermonuclear-type fireballs and right on live television. So
that
was not good for the propaganda war vis-a-vis the Soviet Union.
It crumbled within itself.
It basically sat back down, and then it just folded up like an accordion full of fuel, and, of course, the fuel exploded. Oh, and the little satellite, the 6-inch test article, flopped away onto the beach, was actually still beeping after going through all that, and it's hanging with its little antennas bent at weird angles in the Smithsonian. If you go to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, you can actually see this chrome, silver-looking thing with burn marks on it hanging in the ceiling. That's the actual Sputnik satellite, which is what the world called it, that was a result of the December catastrophe of the first Vanguard launch attempt. Anyway, so in January, the night of January 31, von Braun gets his shot, gets his chance, and they are able on this Jupiter C launch vehicle, which is a modified intercontinental intermediate range ballistic missile, an IRBM, to launch the first U.S. satellite built by JPL called Explorer 1. JPL is the West Coast lab associated with Caltech, which will figure very prominently later in our story tonight.
And what kind of telemetry and data were they going to be able to get from it?
Well, Van Allen, who was a very high-level scientist of the period, worked at the University of Iowa, had been tapped by Stuhlinger, who was one of von Braun's key right-hand Germans, and they'd been talking with him for years. He actually furnished the equipment, and a guy named George Ludwig, who was his chief grad student, you know, grad student slave labor, actually designed the electronics for the radiation detectors that were going to go into Explorer. What's really eerie and makes me very suspicious is that Van Allen, actually designed his radiation gear, which made him a household name, made him famous when Explorer 1 discovered the so-called Van Allen radiation belt in that first few orbits, and then in the succeeding launches of Explorer 3 and Explorer 4. Van Allen actually designed that equipment so that it would fit either into the Vanguard satellite configuration, which was a sphere, or into the Explorer satellite configuration, which was a cylinder.
What's the significance of that?
Well, he was hedging his bets. He knew. He knew there was going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
And he was ready to launch on the second option, which was the Explorer, the Army, the Von Braun option. Normally, scientists are not that broad spectrum. They're very narrow band. You know, when they design equipment, it's basically for one vehicle, for one purpose.
They don't have a backup.
They don't. Well, they may build more than one copy, but it isn't multi-purpose. And this was for the one of the first times in U.S. space history, in fact, maybe the only time I can think of, it was designed to fly on either bird, whichever one would fly first, which was very perspicacious of Dr. Von
Allen. Say that was pretty smart.
Unless he was tipped. Unless he was part of the in crowd, that, and they basically told him, look, you know, James, whichever one goes, you'll be on it. So design it to fit both. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, all the way along the line, you find these little thingies that make you wonder about the official history. So Von Braun, with his Jupiter C, which consisted of a first stage liquid fuel, basically a super kerosene and liquid oxygen, and an upper set of stages, 2, 3, and 4, which were solid rockets designed and built by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which had cut its eye teeth on solid rockets a la Jack Parsons on the West Coast in the 30s and 40s. They put this spacecraft into orbit that night. And as I describe in the paper, and I did this very deliberately, you know, we didn't have the worldwide tracking network then that we have now. So you basically launched your satellite down over the southeastern horizon of the Atlantic Ocean from Cape Canaveral, and then you crossed your fingers and you prayed.
Well, how did they know it made it into space?
They didn't.
They
literally had to wait for it to come all the way back around the entire world until it came over California, where they set up some special radio listening gear in the deserts just north of San Diego, a place called Earthquake Valley, which, of course, makes you sleep really well at night.
Yeah.
And they were waiting for the signal, and they had a phone line, a long-distance telephone line complete with an operator. Remember those?
Gosh.
Where you had to actually call an operator to place a long-distance call?
And then she patched you in.
She patched you in. Well, they had this line open between the guys in the radio shack. You know, that's where the term came from, Radio Shack, sitting in this Earthquake Valley desert in the middle of the night in Southern California, listening for a beep, 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 you know, when it came over the horizon.
That's
on the
amazing.
Pacific side, and a phone line to Washington where Von Braun and Van Allen and Bill Pickering, the head of JPL, and General Medeiros, who was the head of ABMA, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency, which was technically the group that launched the first satellite, Army all the way, were waiting at the Pentagon for this telephone alert that would tell them from California, we got the signal. Now, look, the theory was that if it had made it all the way around the Earth to where it was flying over California, the damn thing was in orbit.
It was in orbit.
It was up. It was there. And it was supposed to be about 108-minute orbit. Well, they waited, and they waited, and they waited. And, you know, 12:31, 12:32. It was supposed to come over California about 12:30 Eastern time, Eastern Standard Time. 12:33, 12:34, nothing. There are pictures I have in this paper that were taken that night of Medeiros and Pickering and Von Braun, and they're priceless.
Oh, is that, that's the shots of them kind of like with phones in their ear and stuff?
Yeah, with phones and their expressions. I mean, Von Braun looks like he had just, he learned that his mother had died.
Well, they didn't have computers then for mathematics.
Very primitive computers, but they didn't have the radio tracking. There were no worldwide tracking network. You literally sent this thing around the world, and you had to wait for it to come back around.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like that old joke, you know, if you throw a baseball fast enough, away from the Earth, it'll come back and hit you in the back of the head in billions of years. Well, you literally had to wait for this satellite, if it was a satellite, to make its way all around the Earth and to come back over the first piece of land that it was going to fly over where you had a radio station, which in this case was San Diego, to tell you that it was, in essence, in orbit.
So they were projecting when this would happen, exactly. So they were off by a little
bit. Well, remember, the Newtonian mechanics of satellites is really, really, really simple. You know, it's not the economy, stupid. It's Newton laws, which are really, really, really basic. Again, any kid, you know, high school kid can use these to figure out satellite orbits.
Unless there was another anomaly.
Well, unless there was a huge anomaly. So they have a rocket of known thrust, known fuels, known everything. They launch this sucker up from Cape Canaveral into the darkness of the southeast skies from Cape Canaveral. It disappears over the horizon. They get radio confirmation that they've got the firing of the first stage and it drops away, and the second stage and it drops away, and then the third stage and the fourth stage, and it disappears and they don't hear anything, and they don't have enough data to know whether it really was going fast enough, and more important, in the right direction, because the directional pointing of these early boosters was very primitive, to know whether it had actually made it into orbit. There were certain... You have to be firing your engines when you're parallel to the Earth's surface. Otherwise, you're wasting the energy going up or going down, and you don't go into orbit. You basically crash back into the Atlantic Ocean.
And they probably had no idea where it went.
They didn't. They had zero idea, and they're waiting. And the predicted time for the orbit that they wanted, which was 200 miles by 1,000. I'm sorry, 2,200. 220 by 1,000. Would have given them roughly 108-minute orbit at, by the way, 33.33 degrees to the equator.
How convenient.
That was kind of cute. And they were waiting on the phone for California to say, okay, we got it. And the time came and went when they were supposed to, if it was in orbit, get that call, and nothing happened. And nothing happened, nothing happened, nothing happened. And I have actual quotes from von Braun's, you know, journal when he wrote for the Iowa Sunday Register a couple months later, the awful feeling that they'd blown it. You know, it hadn't gone into orbit. It had gone into the drink. It
right.
Nosedive into the South Atlantic. At 12:42, something like 12 minutes past its due date, the California stations suddenly get the signal. And they know they've got it in orbit. And everybody goes wild. They're all applauding. They're raced by cars from the Pentagon, where they were not supposed to have a press conference, because remember, Eisenhower didn't want this to look overtly military
right. Even
then. So they run them all over to the National Academy of Sciences, which is across the river and up, I think it's Independence Avenue, you know, up by the Capitol, up by the Smithsonian, up in northeast Washington, to have a press conference at 2 a.m. with absolutely a packed room of press from all over the world.
So, the media knew there was a launch, right?
The media knew they had staked out the Cape. They weren't invited in those days. You know, they kind of were miles away waiting and looking, so they knew there had been a launch. They saw the thing light up the sky and dart up into the darkness on the Redstone first stage. But they didn't know anything until there was an official announcement. It was not like 24/7 news cycles now.
Right.
It was the dark ages. And most of them were print people. There were some radio guys there. There was maybe one or two television guys, but it was basically newspapers.
And it was film then, too.
And it was film. Yeah, film at 11.
Yep, that's
except
true.
This was film at 2 a.m. So they run them over there. They have this press conference. And nobody, particularly von Braun, says anything about the absolutely impossible, amazing, magical, it cannot have happened thing which had already happened, that all the inside guys had to have known happened, and no one was saying anything. Namely, that when this sucker was put into orbit that night, with a known rocket, with known thrust, known efficiencies, known fuels, known everything, its eventual orbit was one-third higher, George, than it possibly should have been. One-third higher. 600 extra miles appeared out of nowhere in the orbit of Explorer 1.
What happened?
Well, there's no way that could happen. Now, the excuse within the community was, oh, Bill Pickering's upper stage rockets had been more efficient than they were supposed to be, because these were solid fuel rockets and solid.
A little too strong for what they thought.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's what's amazing to me, and this is why when everybody's reading this, and of course, the website's getting hammered now because everybody's trying to get in to download this paper. By the way, do everybody a favor. Don't read it online. Get in, download it, and then get off so the next guys can get in. Because if you don't get off, I won't be able to upload.
Yeah, and it's a long article to read.
It's very long, yeah. And you're going to want to read it several times, because this is not, I'm not writing for kiddies here. I'm writing for the real crowd. And we'll get into that maybe in the next hour, some of the interesting feedback I've had. But the amazing, it simply should not have happened thing was this orbit was one-third bigger. One-third bigger, 600 miles bigger than they'd planned. Now, that is one hell of a bump to hide under the carpet.
Is that a mistake?
No. There's no way, because the fuels simply were not able of giving that bang for the buck. Remember, this rocket science is a science because you're always dealing with specific... I mean, the Newton's laws, as I said before, are 300 years old, minus, you know, a decade or two. It's not like this was born yesterday. The fuel, the solid stages were developed over 20 years by JPL. The solid fuel rockets of the booster had been developed from the V2 heritage. The Redstone was basically a souped-up V2, you know, that Von Braun spent 10 years from the deserts here in New Mexico at White Sands, going back to Huntsville in Alabama. And then the Jupiter C was a modified, souped-up version of that with extended tanks, and it was called a Hydyne fuel, which was a higher-energy fuel. Everything was known. So to get a 30% increase in performance, I mean, it would be like in this day and age of 450 a gallon gas. You start out knowing that you're, you know, Tom is listening, right?
Tom is listening.
Yeah, Tom gets 17 miles to the gallon when he's not using these
right
things.
Right.
It would be suddenly if he was getting 28 miles to the gallon. And what? There was no possible reason why suddenly he should jump up with having done nothing to his engine from 17 to 28.
Well, who was the one who said there's something strange here?
Nobody.
Not even Von Braun?
Nobody said anything. That's what's so absolutely amazing, and how I know that the lid of secrecy, the heavy hand of cover-up, the classification at the highest levels, obviously, of the White House, descended that same night. Now, none of the press guys asked any questions. Von Braun never volunteered that, you know. In fact, 2 months later, and I have this reproduced in the paper, the actual verbatim words he used in the Iowa, you know, Sunday Register piece, where we made a slight miscalculation in the orbital period. Slight. 30%. You don't make a 30% error in rocket science and do anything.
It wasn't, according to you, a miscalculation.
Well, it's not according to me. Again, these are equations I've had now, the actual rocket equation, plugging in all the numbers from the publicly available data on the Jupiter C, the rockets, the fuel they were using, the thrust levels, the number of pounds of fuel, the tonnage, everything is all there in this first paper. Nobody, and remember, I have a lot of critics. If I had made any mistakes along the line in calculating all of this, I would have been excoriated. You know, you would have heard 50,000 emails from people saying, oh, Hoagland's blown it again, that kind of thing. Nobody's been able to pick holes in the science because there are no holes to pick. This is an absolute miracle. 600 extra miles appeared in Explorer 1's orbit that night from nowhere, from literally out of magic land.
When we come back, Richard, tell us why. And our special guest, Richard C. Hoagland, soon to be joined with Joseph Farrell, and then phone calls in the last hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. So somewhere along the line, Richard C., they discovered by accident anti-gravity, some major effect?
Well, you start out with these basic celestial mechanics. You do something that 300-year-old Newton's laws say is really simple. It's thrust, it's weight, it's fuel, it's all knowns. You throw this thing into space that night, and it winds up in an orbit one-third bigger than it ever possibly could have. And the astonishing thing is that everybody in the press, who's supposed to be covering this doesn't ask a damn question. None of the other science guys asked any questions. Even Van Allen's chief guy, Ludwig, who I quote extensively in the in this paper series, accepts the idea at face value. This is a physicist, accepts the idea at face value that, oh, it had to be the rockets. Now, in defense of all these stupid people, I'm sorry.
Don't hold back here.
I'm going to, you know, kind of pull my punches tonight and not tell you what I really think. In defense of all these people, remember, we're dealing with a physics that makes this impossible. By every mainstream thing, all of these bright geniuses thought they knew this was impossible. Therefore, it had to be the rockets. It had to be. There was no other explanation. Now, von Braun, and this is where things get really cool, von Braun, by his actions, completely vindicates what I'm going to tell you for the rest of this program. Because what he started doing secretly, clandestinely,
on his own,
obviously without a sanction by the White House, by the Army, by anybody, he started sending out correspondence, letters. Remember good old letters? This was before email. These are actual letters that we believe are in his files in the National Archive, if they haven't been sanitized. And obviously we are trying to get in there and get a view of the originals. The fortunate thing is that some of the correspondents with whom he corresponded all over the world have publicly acknowledged and published their side of the conversation. So we know this correspondence existed. Now, who was he corresponding with? He was corresponding with the coolest, neatest, most far-out physicists existing on the planet in this time frame, 58, 59, 60, et cetera, et cetera. And what was he talking to them about? Anti-gravity experiments, anti-gravity technology, anti-gravity theories of physics that would throw Einstein, relativity, and Newton, you know, three laws, laws of gravitation, into the ash can, looking for a real physics which could explain the miracle that he knew had been accomplished that night that he was not telling anybody about publicly.
Now, this event was an accident.
No.
They didn't anticipate it.
Oh, yeah. It was
that's what I mean. Yeah.
Now, if it was a one-of-a-kind, you could say, okay, Hoagland, you know, they just had they were really lucky with that batch. You know, Bill Pickering just mixed up one hell of a batch of fuel.
And off it went.
But, of course, he didn't do the mixing. This was, you know, done by, I think it was Aerojet General that actually made the rockets. Point is, this was only the first of multiple instances of the same damn thing happening.
So each time you're saying they launched, they were up by 30%?
Von Braun launched, he had five satellites in the Explorer series that he was going to try to launch. He made three out of five. He missed with two. He missed with five. He made it with three and four. So one, three, and four were successful. Three out of five. That's not bad.
That's
not bad in those days.
That's
that was phenomenal.
Good. Yeah.
Because like 50% of the rockets, you know, that you set up came back down without going anywhere, except boom. So now, all of these Explorer launches, again, this is all on the web. The links are in the paper. Follow the links. Don't just read the paper. Follow the links. I spend a lot of time putting links in because that's the way you now reference. And the links go to primary sources, NASA, Smithsonian, et cetera, et cetera, Marshall, which is the Marshall Space Flight Center, which von Braun was director of for you know, 30 years. The links are there for a reason. Follow the links, and you'll get to the primary source data. The two other satellites in the Explorer series, Explorer 3 and Explorer 4, also achieved incredibly anomalous orbits. And the first one is interesting because it was even slightly better than Explorer 1. But that's explained because the perigee was slightly under the 2,200 miles. I'm sorry, 220 miles.
But now explain this to me, though. Was there some kind of anti-gravity effect there?
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
I'm going to try to do this very methodically so people can follow step by step. Don't want to leave any steps
out. Or did the rocket create it? So that's what you got to tell me.
No, absolutely not. The rocket did not create this. There's no way the burning, the fuels, the energy in the fuels, the nothing about the that part of the process.
Could not do that. Okay.
Was in, you know, and this is why Von Braun, remember, Von Braun was on the cover of Time magazine. I got a picture of him in the first paper tonight, showing him on the cover of Time, listed as Mr. Missile Man. What is a rocket guy doing writing clandestinely to cutting-edge physicists all over the planet right after Explorer 1, asking about cool alternative physics that can explain his satellite's unbelievable orbit? The answer is there's no way to explain this except he knew instantly it was not normal. It was not his rocket. It was not his bird. It was nothing that he did or could have done. The numbers simply tell you.
Or was aware of.
Well, he was aware of it. He was not aware.
He wasn't aware of it prior to.
No. It was a surprise.
Right.
After the fact, it was like, holy, I can't say that.
Well, but if it continued to happen on the
it
other.
It kept happening.
Other,
yeah.
Then didn't they have to factor that in on all the subsequent launches later on, Apollo and everything else?
Well, that would have been the worst case nightmare. The scenario is that you can't launch anything and depend on Newton. And remember, they did not know how damaging or how this would propagate or under what conditions. So it was total unpredictability. This literally, if they hadn't figured it out, as I say in part one, would have been a showstopper to the entire U.S. space program.
Did the Russians have the same problem?
Eventually they did, and they figured it out, and they fixed it. Now, obviously, there was no communication between what the Russians were doing and what we were doing, what Von Braun was doing. So they obviously figured it out separately. And in part two, I explain how they figured it out, and in part two, I explain everything about this, and that's why we're going to post that tonight after everybody gets to read part one.
Well, when you say fixed it, why didn't they use it as opposed to fix it?
Well, they did both. Remember, when I say fix it, if you launch, you know that old nursery rhyme? I shot an arrow into the air. It fell to earth. I know not where.
Yes.
That was their problem. They were going by Newtonian mechanics, and suddenly their predictions by this 300-plus-year-old database.
Out the window.
Were out the window. And, I'm trying to think of an everyday analogy. It's like if you go to your ATM and you think you got so much money in there, and suddenly you find you've got 10 times more.
Or in my case, 10 times less.
10 times less. Well, but remember, this was they were fat. They were getting something for nothing, and they didn't have no idea where the nothing was coming from, but they couldn't count on it. Because when they launched Explorer 4, they only got 1/6 of the effect.
But are you saying that they discovered, by accident, some kind of anti-gravity field or effect?
That's what it
out
like
there in space.
That's exactly what it looked like. Now, here's something really cool. Not only did the Army encounter this, Von Braun's group, but when the Navy finally got their act together and they launched their three Vanguard satellites, three out of 11 that they planned.
Same thing happened?
The same thing happened.
And they didn't share that with them?
Well, we don't know. Yeah. Again, the Army and the Navy were not really talking to each other. There was this inter-service rivalry that we've heard so much about as the reason why Eisenhower eventually created NASA to try to bring peace to the family, to give a super agency that would kind of keep everybody in their proper place and would be civilian and open and above board and accountable to the American taxpayer. Yeah, sure. We'll get into that in a minute.
Well, and also tell me, why is this important? If they stumbled into this anti-gravity effect, why is that important?
Well, the first reason it's important is because if you can't predict it, you can't have a space program. Remember, if Eisenhower was going to have an open skies satellite look down on the Soviets,
right,
you have to put a spacecraft into a predictable orbit so that it's over a specific missile base at a specific time. You open the shutter, you take the picture. You re-enter it where you want. You're able to retrieve the film. If none of that was predictable, then open skies was out the window. Satellite reconnaissance was out the window. You couldn't send a spacecraft to the moon. Now, this, by the way, propagated into the early efforts of the U.S. to have a moon race with the Russians and to win it. In 1959, toward the end of 58, into 59, Eisenhower created in the beginning of 58 something called ARPA in the Department of Defense, in the Pentagon, the Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few months later, he signed the legislation that created NASA, and ARPA basically went behind the scenes and only worked on military stuff. But for a while, ARPA was controlling both the civilian guys in space and the military guys in space, although it was really all military. Are we confused yet?
Holding on.
Okay. So ARPA decided to basically up the ante, faced with urging from Bill Pickering, remember the director of JPL, who had built the Explorer satellite, who was von Braun's best bud for years and years and years. And he had proposed, Pickering had proposed back as early as 54, that they go to the moon. And again, he'd been turned down flat. Nobody wanted to do anything to upstage the Russians until I think the Russians did their thing and we all went, had conniption fits and kittens. So after Sputnik, he got a green light, Pickering did. And the ARPA people, the Advanced Research Project Agency in the Pentagon that Eisenhower had quickly formed in March of 58, within a couple months of the successful Explorer 1, they decided to create a moon program of unmanned launches running for the next year or two called the Pioneer Series. And they gave half the launches roughly to the Air Force and half to the Army.
Why were they split it up like that?
They were trying to keep the services all happy.
All right.
You know, inter-service rivalry. I mean, you were in the Navy.
Well, yeah, but it sounds like redundancy, doesn't it?
Oh, well, yeah, but remember, it's not their money.
True.
It's our money. So they were trying to keep peace in the family. And plus, you had this core of expertise. You know, you had the Army guys, you had the Navy guys, you know, who knew basically how to throw rockets into the sky. So you had to depend on those people to do what you wanted to do, even if you were, quote, doing it for science. So this was the first fledgling moon race with the Soviets. And we lost that one. The reason we lost that one is that von Braun, the Air Force simply blew it. Every rocket they put up blew up, flew sideways, did everything it was not supposed to do. They never got near the moon. When it became von Braun's turn, he basically used a souped-up version of his Jupiter C called Juno 2.
Mm-hmm.
Same configuration, except bigger tanks, that kind of thing. And he was able to launch a little, it was kind of like a typewriter-sized satellite, shaped like a cone.
And they thought he was a hero.
Well, he did the best of what he had. Anyway, the Soviets tried in, I think, the early fall of 58 with their Luna 1, and they missed. They missed the moon by 3,700 miles, and they weren't using any kind of technology.
3,700 or 1,000?
3,700 miles. 3,700 miles, they missed the moon.
That's kind of close, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but they missed.
Yeah.
And according to the specs that I have, again, linked directly to Soviet sources on the website, they should have been able to hit the moon within 60 miles. And the moon is 2,160 miles across, so 60 miles is the size of the crater Copernicus, you know, near the center of the moon when you look at the moon on a full moon night.
So they missed something.
They missed it by its own diameter and then some, another 1,000 miles. Not good. Now, von Braun launches a few weeks later, and his spacecraft misses the moon by 37,000 miles.
Okay. That's what I saw.
10 times the distance, the missed distance of the Russians.
How could he be so far off?
Exactly. So I'm looking at all this data, I'm pulling this all together, and I'm saying, okay, two problems are really here. Because, look, there's no way you can have an Apollo program. There's no way you can have a viable effort to beat the Russians with anything if you are missing the moon by, you know, 10, 15 times its own diameter. You can't do anything that had been visioned. Now we're into the Kennedy era, you know, 61. It was not until 1962 in April that, and again, I tell the story and the chronology and the events, that I think both von Braun and Pickering figured it out. They realized what had gone wrong with their early space efforts, and they were able to implement a fix that would allow them to predictably, this is the key thing, predictably put things into space where they wanted them, when they wanted them, and get them back. And obviously, if you couldn't do all that, you couldn't put human beings into space because you'd kill them.
By factoring in this anti-gravity effect?
Exactly.
Did they ultimately end up using this for spaceships?
We don't know. That's part of the hidden mystery. And the only way I've been able to approach this is through circumstantial physics. Remember, a lot of other people in the community that you talk to, including the UFO community, they are constantly depending on sources. They're depending upon this guy to leak something and that guy to leak something. Okay, we don't. We over here at Enterprise, except for a couple of people who've proven extremely reliable and whom we constantly check anyway with the physics, with hard data, with real science, we do not depend on sources. When I come on and I say a so-and-so source told me, it's because I have additional confirmation from another mechanism, usually the physics, usually figuring it out in terms of the numbers, that backs up what our source or sources have told us. So we had to do this by the numbers, and the numbers say that around 62, April of 62, actually around my birthday of 62, April 25th, they figured it out. And from then on, they were able to successfully place spacecraft into precise orbits. They were able to literally hit the moon where they wanted to, when they wanted to. And that is when von Braun suddenly reversed a four-year position standing in the way of the implementation of the entire Apollo program. And that story is in the first part of the paper. And he reversed course and admitted to the idea of lunar orbit rendezvous, which made Apollo possible. Because remember, if you can't launch things into space reliably on predictable trajectories, you can't rendezvous. You can't bring two guys together in spacecraft. You can't send them down to the moon and bring them back up and have them get together. They'll die of starvation or lack of air in orbit. So everything was contingent on solving this celestial mechanics nightmare. Now, the flip side of this coin is that we haven't spoken yet, and we're going to actually drag our feet and not do it until the top of the hour, to what the upside of this whole thing was that magically, out of nowhere, 600 extra miles appeared not only in the Explorer program consistently, but in the Vanguard program. Do you know that the Vanguard satellites, those three little satellites and one bigger one, are in the highest orbits of any man-made object put into space at the dawn of the space age? And some estimates out are that they will last 2,000 years.
You mean they're still up there?
They're still up there. The three Vanguard satellites, which were, by the way, if you go and you look at the literature, the Navy guys were worried that they could barely make orbit for 2 weeks. When they made their orbits, they also went consistently much higher than they should have. In fact, their orbits are so much higher that they're up out of the air resistance to where they literally could be up there for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. We could all disappear, George, in 2012 or whenever, a global nuclear war, if Putin has his way, and the next wave of civilization could look up and still see those satellites orbiting around the Earth as leftovers from that previous epoch and those dumb idiot guys that blew themselves to kingdom come.
Of course, is there a secret space program? We'll talk with Richard C. about that. Joseph Farrell joins us. We'll be back.